Well, it was a cold, foggy morning when two travellers set out on a perilous expedition. They carried in their bags a precious cargo. They carried no less than four of Paul's letters. And their journey would take them 1,500 kilometres. From the gates of Rome, they headed east to the mountain range that runs down the spine of Italy and crossed that mountain range until they reached the other side in the Adriatic Sea. And there they found passage to cross pirate-infested waters until they reached the other side, Dalmatia, full of bandit-infested passes. And if they made it safely through Dalmatia, then they would make their way through the hazardous mountains to the north of Macedonia until they reached at last the Dardanelles, where 2,000 years later the Anzacs would land. And then crossing the Dardanelles, they would finally reach Asia. They travelled down the west coast of Asia until they reached their first destination, which was Ephesus. And there they delivered the first of four letters, because these two men were mailmen. They then journeyed on into the heart of Asia until they reached the Lycus Valley, where they handed over the second of four letters in the city known as Laodicea. And then just up the road from Laodicea, they reached their final destination after 1,500 kilometres and many weeks later, and after encountering many dangers since they left Rome, they came to Colossae. And there they handed over the last two of those four precious letters, one a private letter to the wealthiest man in town, a man by the name of Philemon, and the other a fourth letter to the leaders of the church of Colossae. So we're now at the end of this letter that we've been studying off and on for the last 12 months. And for me anyway, the journey has been every bit as interesting as the journey that those two mailmen who first delivered the church found their journey to be. And here at the end of this letter, we're able to put some names and see something of the character of just some of those that worked with Paul in the work of the gospel back in the early days of the Christian church. Now, we know that Paul is the most famous missionary, the most famous church planter in the history of the church. But he didn't do it on his own. In fact, without the help of his friends, he would never have accomplished anything that was worthwhile or anything that was of lasting value. Lone Ranger type Christians are useless. They're more trouble than they're worth. Had Paul been a lone ranger type Christian, he too would have been useless. But he wasn't. He was very much a people person. He had more friends than most people have on Facebook, and these were real friends. If someone's count is correct, there are more than 100 different Christians associated with Paul in the book of Acts and his epistles alone. Most of these friends Paul saw as part of the same team. As I say, Paul was not a lone ranger, he was very much a team player. Now, some of you know, I'm not much of a sports fan, but I believe that in the game of rugby league, and please don't correct me until afterwards, I believe that there are two teams, I think I've got that much right, and that each team has 13 players, and they play for 80 minutes, which in a roughly equal game means that each side will have possession of the ball for 40 minutes. And that means that each of the 13 players will have possession of the ball on average for a total of 3 minutes. For some players, those 3 minutes will be 3 minutes of glory. For some, not. And sadly, some players will live just for those 3 minutes of glory. But the true character of a team player is not what he is in those three precious minutes when he has possession of the ball, The true character of a team player shows up in the 77 minutes when he doesn't have possession of the ball. How does he play then when he's not in the spotlight? And that's the true test of your character too. What do you do when someone else has the ball? When someone else is in the limelight? When you're the supporting member and not the star of the game? T.S. Eliot wrote, "Half the harm that is done in this world is due to people who want to feel important. They don't mean to do harm, but the harm does not interest them, or they do not see it, or they justify it, because they are absorbed in the endless struggle to think well of themselves. Half the harm that is done in all the world." Now, Paul was a team player. He was anxious to know where and how everyone else who was playing, how they were doing. And he was anxious to know, or he was anxious that they would know where and how he was playing and how he was doing. And one of the reasons for sending these two mailmen 1,500 kilometres across the world was just for this purpose. He says in verse 7, "Tychicus, a beloved brother, faithful minister and fellow servant of the Lord, will tell you all the news about me. I'm sending him to you for this very purpose, that he may know your circumstances and comfort your hearts." And then he mentions Onesimus and he says, "They will make known to you all things which are happening here." So Paul had this great burden for people. And it wasn't just that he remembered their names. He also cared deeply for them. And he also had a great burden to support those that he shared the ministry with. He knew he was part of a team. He was not concerned to be the only player on the field. And today we're going to meet some of these other players. Now, as I contemplated this, those that we're going to meet in the closing verses of the Epistle to the Colossians, there was one great ability that shone through that made them useful. And I think it is this great ability that makes any Christian most useful in the Lord's service, and without which a Christian is useless. The one great ability. Last Saturday night we enjoyed a very enjoyable Not a Talent night, though I think we would all agree that there was more talent than not a talent there. We have some people with some truly amazing, truly awesome, truly tutiful abilities, don't we? And we were looking at this further on Sunday night when we were considering the question, well, how can I know what my gifts and talents are and how can I use them in the Lord's service? And all those talents that we saw on Saturday night can be used well in the Lord's service. Or, as sometimes sadly happens today, they can also very quickly take you away from the Lord. That's the nature of gifts and abilities. But there is one ability that is basic to all usefulness in the Lord's service. Without this ability, all other talents and gifts fall flat. And that ability, which is basic to the usefulness of all our gifts, is dependability. Dependability, or the lack of it, is what strikes me most in the lives of these Christians that we meet here in the closing verses of Colossians. Well, the Old Testament word for this is chesed, which, as I pointed out before, is best translated as something like loyal love. It is that characteristic which is so absent from so much of society today, loyalty or loyal love. The psalmist cries out in one of the psalms, he says, "Help, Lord, for no one is faithful anymore. Those who are loyal have vanished from the human race." We see that today. Loyalty doesn't make money. Loyalty doesn't get you anywhere. Loyalty doesn't allow you any more than 3 minutes of fame when you're playing the game. And so loyalty is not high on most people's lists of what is required to survive. "Help, Lord, For no one is faithful anymore. Those who are loyal have vanished from the human race, was the psalmist's cry. But this is where Paul's friends shine. We're reading in Proverbs about some of the aspects of friendship, and this is one of the aspects of friendship that really shines. These friends of Paul were loyal. Loyal, first of all, to Christ and to the gospel, but also loyal to Paul and loyal to one another, because like Paul, they were team players. Let's have a look at some of these. So first of all, the two mailmen. One of them was a long-term companion of Paul's, and the other was a runaway slave. Paul was not interested in status or wealth or power when it came to whom he worked with in the kingdom of God. They were not the qualities he looked for. And if you look at Paul's friends, you'll find that among them, there was, yes, this long-term companion of Paul's, even the friends that we've got here before us today, and there was a runaway slave, and there was a well-educated doctor who turned historian, and there was a restored backslider. Let's just look at those first two, the long-term companion and the runaway slave. We've already seen that they risked life and limb to be able to deliver Paul's letter, and also to be able to go to those in Asia and to tell them all the news about Paul, as well as to know how those in Asia were doing, to know their circumstances and to comfort the hearts of those in Colossae. That was a principal purpose for which Paul sent them. So these were term players. They were dependable. They were not go-getters just trying to get ahead. And Paul loved these two men. You'll notice that both of them he refers to as faithful and beloved. There is first of all the long-term companion. His name was Tychicus. He was, says Paul, a beloved brother and a faithful minister and a fellow servant in the Lord. Or when Paul wrote to the Ephesians, because you remember Tychicus first dropped off a letter to the church in Ephesus on his way to Colossae, and in that letter, Paul again refers to Tychicus and he calls him a beloved brother and a faithful minister in the Lord. Now, Paul and Tychicus go way back. Well, a while back anyway. Tychicus had accompanied Paul on his third missionary journey that was about 4 years before. And now he's given up his own time to be with Paul in Rome, probably to share some of his confinement when he was in prison. And now that Paul is in Rome in prison and he's looking around for a trustworthy witness to his affairs that he can send to Colossae as well as to Ephesus with those epistles and also to get to know what's happening there and to let them know what's happening with him, he chooses Tychicus. And then later on, when Paul is writing to Titus, which is after this time, and Paul senses that Titus, who's in Crete, is in need of support, and so he says in Titus chapter 3 and verse 12 that he's thinking he'll probably send Tychicus to help him because he knows that this is a man that he can depend upon. And then later again, in fact, just before Paul is executed, knowing that Timothy needs a hand in Ephesus, again it's Tychicus that comes to mind that he sends there. That's in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12. And Paul really ached to be able to help Timothy in faraway Ephesus, but there's no way he can get out of prison. He knows that he's going to be executed soon. He wants to be there, but you see, this is a team, and it doesn't really matter if it's he that is there or not, just as long as someone is there to be able to help Timothy, someone reliable, someone dependable. And that's Tychicus, a beloved brother, faithful minister. He's a faithful minister. You can rely upon him. And he is a fellow servant in the Lord. The other mailman is a runaway slave. And his name is Onesimus. And he too is described by Paul as faithful and beloved. But he hadn't always been faithful. He'd run away from his master Philemon, who lived in Colossae, and he'd run all the way to Rome. We don't quite know how a runaway slave successfully crossed half the Roman Empire to reach Paul in Rome. We don't even know why he came to Paul, because at the time Onesimus was not a Christian. But he did. He got there. And while he was with Paul in Rome, he was converted. And he not only became a Christian, he became dependable, so dependable in fact that Paul didn't even want to send him back. And he tells Philemon when he is sending him back, he's telling him of the real struggle he had just to let him go, because he says, he who was once unprofitable to you is now profitable or useful to you and to me. That's the way he saw Onesimus. So Onesimus is now useful. He is also faithful. He is dependable. And Paul has no qualms trusting that Onesimus will return to his master when he sends him back. Nor does he have any problem trusting that Onesimus can be relied upon to tell the truth as to what Paul's circumstances are in Rome, and to make known to those in Colossae all things that are happening in Rome. So Onesimus has become this dependable, useful person, though he once wasn't. And then also with Paul in Rome are three Jews. Their names are Aristarchus, Mark, and Jesus Justus. So these were the only Jewish believers that were with Paul in Rome, or at least the only ones that he could really rely upon. His fellow countrymen who were not Christians, other Jews in Rome, wanted nothing to do with Paul. In fact, probably they wanted him dead, as the Jews did back in Jerusalem. But even many of the Jews who had become Christians living in Rome, apparently they were keeping their distance from Paul. They were wary of Paul. They blew hot and cold. You couldn't depend upon them. Sometimes they were supportive, and sometimes they were just too worried about what the Jewish community in Rome, who were not Christians, thought of them. So they didn't want to be too closely identified with Paul. But here were three men who didn't care what others thought of them. They were focused on the gospel. They were focused on the same cause that Paul was focused on, which is always the best glue of friendship. They were wholly dependable. So who are they? Well, there is another long-term companion. His name is Aristarchus. And he, like Epaphras later on, Paul refers to as my fellow prisoner. So he's given up his own liberty in order to share in Paul's suffering in Rome. He's prepared to be in prison with Paul just so that he can be a support to him. And like Tychicus that we looked at beforehand, Aristarchus and Paul go way back, again at least to Paul's third missionary journey. And on that journey, Paul spent most of his time, in fact he spent more than 2 years on his third missionary journey, in Ephesus, and Aristarchus was with Paul there during those 2 years in Ephesus. And there you might remember that during that time there were those with commercial interests who saw lots of people turning and becoming Christians, and they were turning away from their idols, and they made their money selling idols, and so they got a bit narked by this and they stirred up a riot. And during that riot they seized Aristarchus and also another friend of Paul's by the name of Gaius. And so Aristarchus was quite prepared to suffer along with Paul for the sake of the gospel. And then he had accompanied Paul on his ill-fated journey to Jerusalem, returning from his third missionary journey. And there in Jerusalem, Paul had been arrested and he'd been thrown into prison. This time he was in prison for 2 years in Jerusalem and Caesarea. And all that time Aristarchus stuck by Paul. And then after 2 years, Paul is sent on a prison ship to Rome, and Aristarchus goes with him on that prison ship. And on the way, they are shipwrecked, and they're in danger of losing their lives. But they both survive, and they both finally reach Rome. And there in Rome, Aristarchus still sticks with Paul, and he shares his imprisonment. So that is Aristarchus. Faithful Aristarchus, good old dependable Aristarchus, he stuck with Paul through riots and voyages and storms and shipwrecks and imprisonment. The second Jewish companion he has with him in Rome is a deserter that had come good. And this is Mark, or John Mark, as he is usually known. And he was not dependable, not at first anyway. We think that John Mark was a very early disciple. He was even present and ran away when Jesus was arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. And then later on it was his mother, who was another Mary, who had a house in Jerusalem where the early church used to meet to pray. But John Mark is best known for the fact that he was chosen to accompany Paul and Barnabas, or Barnabas and Paul they were known as at that stage. Barnabas was the number one. And he was chosen to accompany Barnabas and Paul on their first missionary journey. So that goes way back. That goes, you know, 10 years back before Paul's in prison in Rome. And maybe Barnabas was the prime mover there because Mark was Barnabas's cousin. So I imagine Barnabas said to Paul, look, I've got this cousin and, you know, he's going to be a good bloke. Let's bring him along on our first missionary journey. But not long into that journey, John Mark gets cold feet and he turns back. He was not dependable. Why did he give up? Well, we don't know exactly. Perhaps he was afraid because they were moving into dangerous territory. Or perhaps he resented the fact that Paul was now becoming more and more the leader, taking over the leadership. His cousin Barnabas was no longer in the limelight. Or maybe with his Jewish background, maybe he felt a bit uneasy that the mission was moving more and more towards the Gentiles. We don't know exactly. All we know is that someone who spits the dummy like this, for whatever reason, cannot be depended on. And for this reason, when Paul and Barnabas were setting out on their second missionary journey, and Barnabas again wanted to be taking along his cousin, the young John Mark, Paul absolutely refused. It was too great a risk. They cannot risk carrying with them all this dangerous baggage, and someone who is not dependable is dangerous baggage on a mission like this. Barnabas insists, Paul refuses, and eventually the two split up and go their separate ways, Paul finding another young man to accompany them, Timothy, to take John Mark's place. That was all 10 years before. So it's now 10 years later, all is forgiven, all is forgotten. And in verse 10, Paul says, Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, about whom you received instructions, if he comes to you, welcome him. You know, there's an even more telling point when it comes to the way Paul saw Mark, and you skip forward about 5 or 6 years and Paul is again in prison, and this time he is near death. His execution is probably only a matter of days or weeks away. And in prison, near death, Paul writes to Timothy and he says this, he says, get Mark. He means that nicely. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry. And that word useful there is the same word that he uses to describe Onesimus in his letter to Philemon, where he says of Onesimus, he who was once unprofitable to you is now profitable or useful to you and me. Onesimus was now useful, he was dependable. And now Mark is useful. He was not useful when he was not dependable. He was not useful when he gave up, either because he was afraid or because he was irritated by the current leadership. But now he's learnt and he's become dependable. He is now useful. What did it take for this transformation to take place for John Mark to overcome his fickleness and learn to be dependable? There are three influences that we can discern were at work. The first and most obvious one was Paul's discipline. The fact that Paul refused to indulge John Mark until he had proved himself would have been a huge help to the young man. Probably didn't think so at the time, but I'm sure he was thankful to Paul in the end. The second, no doubt, would have been Barnabas. Although I think Barnabas was wrong at the time of the second missionary journey, yet I think he probably later on saw his error because he and Paul were wonderfully reconciled to each other. But Barnabas also had the nickname of Mr. Encourager. I'm sure he was a great help to his young cousin to not give up. And the third influence, which we can be reasonably sure of, would have been the Apostle Peter. We know that Peter knew John Mark well from the early days of Jesus' ministry. Peter even calls him my son. That might mean that Mark was actually converted under Peter's ministry. And later on he is with Peter when Peter is somewhere, Babylon or Rome or somewhere. So I'm sure Peter was also a great help to young Mark. Don't despair if you have let people down because you were not dependable. Just learn from your mistakes. Seek out those who will help you, and you will become useful again. The third Jewish friend that Paul had with him in Jerusalem was the unknown soldier. His name is Jesus Justice. The unknown soldier, because although he fought alongside Paul in the Lord's battle, we don't know anything else about him. He's like all those faithful believers who are dependable, who serve God faithfully, but whose deeds are not announced for the whole world to know. And that's a mark of faithfulness. That is a mark of dependability. It's not about everyone knowing what you're doing. It's just about hanging in there, sticking with it, and knowing that you're serving the Lord. As well as those three Jews, Paul had with him three Gentiles. We know they're Gentiles because they're not part of the only three that he refers to there in verse 11. He had the one who prayed, and the one who stayed, and the one who strayed. The one who prayed, I mean, of course, Epaphras. We've met him before. Like Tychicus, Paul describes him as a fellow servant and faithful minister. He calls him that right back at the beginning of Colossians, chapter 1, verse 7. He's already referred to Epaphras. A faithful servant and fellow minister. He was faithful, he was loyal, he was dependable. Paul could obviously depend upon him. But so could his brothers and sisters in the church back home. Paul tells them that while Epaphras has been with him in Rome, he has never, ever stopped praying for them. In verse 12, Epaphras, who is one of you, a bondservant of Christ, greets you, always laboring fervently for you in prayers, that you may stand perfect and complete in all the will of God. So those back in the church in Colossae could depend upon the fact that Epaphras was praying for them. There was nothing in it for him, at least in worldly terms. But loyalty is not about worldly gain. It's not about promoting yourself in the eyes of the world. It's about being loyal. Loyal to Christ. Loyal to those that you're there to minister to. That was Epaphras. We've met Epaphras before. I won't say any more about him. That was Epaphras, whom Paul calls a faithful minister. And then there is the one who stayed, and that's Luke. In verse 14, Paul says, Luke, the beloved physician, greets you. You notice, like Tychicus and Onesimus, Paul calls him beloved, and for good reason. If anyone deserved the title beloved, it was Luke. Good old, dependable Luke. He was, as it says there, a physician. He was a professional man. He was well trained. He was highly respected. But none of that meant more to him than to be there constantly to support Paul in his labours for Christ and for the gospel. He first appears in the book of Acts on Paul's second missionary journey, where he accompanies Paul and Silas and he reaches Philippi with them, where Paul and Silas, no surprise here, are thrown into jail. And then when Paul and Silas depart from Philippi, it seems that Luke stayed there, but he rejoins Paul when Paul comes through on his third missionary journey. And then he accompanies Paul to Jerusalem, where there was another riot, and Paul was once again thrown into jail, as I said, this time for 2 years. And all this time, there were those that faithfully stuck by Paul, men like Aristarchus that we met before, and also Luke. And then Luke, along with Aristarchus, accompanies Paul on the prison ship to Rome. And they are shipwrecked and they're in danger of losing their lives. But as I said, they survive. They eventually get to Rome. And now Luke, too, is with Paul, supporting him in his imprisonment in Rome. He is a faithful friend. Later on, Luke writes one quarter of the New Testament. You can see him, can't you? There in Rome, sitting at a table with John Mark, and they're excitedly swapping notes and saying, I'm going to write a life of Jesus. And Mark says, yeah, I'm going to write a life of Jesus. What do you reckon about this? What do you reckon about that? And they're sort of going back and forth. Let's not get carried away. But for the present, he's just a faithful friend. And some years later, when Paul is arrested again and again in prison in Rome, and this time, as I've mentioned, he's facing imminent execution, listen to what he writes to Timothy. This is in 2 Timothy 4 and verse 11. He says, only Luke is with me. Only Luke is with me. The very end of Paul's life, his only friend who was still with him, he had lots of friends, and they had to be employed in other places, so they couldn't all be in Rome. But at the end of Paul's life, he says, only Luke is with me. Luke, this well-educated professional who could have got such fame in the world, and yet his most useful ministry was as a faithful, dependable friend supporting Paul. Now I want you to contrast that with the third Gentile who is mentioned here, the one who strayed, and that is Demas. In verse 14, Paul says, and Demas greets you. I referred just then to those poignant words of Paul's that he uttered some years later, not long before he was executed, where he says, only Luke is with me. But they're all the more poignant when you read them in context over there in 2 Timothy chapter 4. This is what he says. 2 Timothy 4 verse 10. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and departed for Thessalonica. Only Luke is with me. When Paul wrote to the Christians in Colossae some years before that, Demas's name is linked with Luke's. And again, when Paul writes to Philemon at the same time, at the end of Philemon, Demas' name is again linked with Luke's, and in that context, Paul calls him my fellow labourer. But what a contrast between the two. Luke gave up the world for the sake of the gospel. Demas gave up the gospel for the sake of the world. Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed. As I said right near the beginning, you can have some remarkable gifts, and you can use those gifts to help you to serve God better, or you can use those gifts to take you away from God altogether. You could also contrast Demas with John Mark. John Mark had proved that he was not dependable early in his career. He was fickle, He'd forsaken Paul for whatever reason. But he was reclaimed and he was restored. The fickle soul can be restored. He can learn to become loyal and dependable. But Demas forsook Paul when Paul most needed him there. He was about to be executed. Demas forsook Paul and apparently, as far as we know, was never reclaimed. He loved this present world too much, that world that John describes in 1 John chapter 2, where he says, the world is the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life, which are those caught up with Demas, we don't know, maybe all three. Or perhaps he just got too used to the luxury and the entertainment and indulging himself, as we see happening in today's generation. Because Christians today give into the world, just as Demas did. It's easy to maintain a religious veneer while all the time we are living for the things of the world. And Demas thought that he could live a double life like that. But eventually the time came when he had to make a decision, and unfortunately he made the wrong decision, and his disloyalty hurt Paul, and it hurt the church, and it hurt himself. Warren Wiersbe says, it must have hurt Paul greatly when Demas forsook him. It also hurt the work of the Lord, for there has never been a time when the labourers were many. But it hurt Demas most of all, for he wasted his life in that which could never last. Don't be a Demas. And then, as well as those who were with Paul in Rome and who sent greetings to the three churches of the Lycus Valley, there were also those in those churches that Paul and his friends particularly sent greetings to. And in particular, there were two church leaders. There was the house church leader, who was Nymphas in verse 15, and Paul says there, greet the brethren who are in Laodicea and Nymphas and the church that is in his house. We don't know a lot about Nymphas. In fact, everything we know is in that verse. But we do know that he opened up his house for the church in Laodicea to meet there. For the first 3 centuries, nearly all churches met in private homes. But there's also the minister, and that's Archippus in verse 17. And say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it. Now, Archippus, we can deduce from Paul's letter to Philemon, was in fact the son of Philemon and his wife Apphia, and the church in Colossae met in the house of Philemon. He was probably one of the wealthiest men in town. Now, at present, the regular pastor from Colossae, who is Epaphras, is 1,500 kilometres away with Paul in Rome, and he's not coming back at the present time. He's not one of the ones who brings the letter back. So who's minding the shop? We think probably Archippus. We think also that probably Archippus was getting discouraged. He was starting to feel the strain, and especially since these new high-profile teachers had come to town and some were leaving the church and following these new high-profile teachers. We don't know exactly what Archippus' problems were, but again, as Warren Wiersbe says, we do know that pastors of local churches face many problems and carry many burdens, and they often need a word of encouragement. So Paul's last words, before he signs off, are directed to Archippus as an encouragement to continue faithfully in the ministry. He needs this encouragement because he himself is struggling, as we all do at times, to continue to be loyal and to continue to be dependable. Dependability is not an easy ability. And sometimes we do find it hard And sometimes it's far easier just to give up and to run away. But we can't run away. Because like Archippus, each one of us has been given our ministry by the Lord himself. That's what Paul says in verse 17. He says, "Say to Archippus, take heed to the ministry which you have received in the Lord, that you may fulfill it." Our ministry, your ministry, my ministry, is a gift from God. Ministry is not something you do for God. Ministry is something that God does in and through you. But the Lord who gave you that ministry is the same Lord who will help you to carry it out. All we need is God's grace. Which is why I think Paul closes with one of the shortest benedictions in any of his epistles. It's simply this: grace be with you. We don't need more programs and more schemes in this church. We need more grace. And we don't need super teachers to come and tell us how to become super Christians, if only we will follow this or that, you know, new surefire technique. And especially we don't need teaching like that, where, as in Colossae, it adds to the work of Christ, because Christ by himself is enough. The grace of Christ is enough. And yes, I know it is hard at times, and we all fail when it comes to being loyal and dependable at times. And we have seen today that some did fail, men like John Mark and Demas. But even when we do fail, we don't have to be like Demas and throw everything away and give up altogether. Because there is grace that can restore a John Mark and make him useful again. So useful that Paul's dying wish is to have John Mark at his side. Grace, grace, God's grace, grace that will pardon and cleanse within, grace that is greater than all my sin. Jesus says, "My grace is enough for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness." Paul says, "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." I can do all things. There is grace to be loyal. There is grace to be dependable. Amen.